that opens, said Danny. And maybe they only happen when the planets are aligned somehow. Maybe there are cycles. Or epicycles, said Hal. Danny's a Virgo, said Zena. I'm not sure how the planets lined up for him, though. It's just a theory, said Danny, and it has nothing to do with astrology. Let's test it, said Vivi. Take these little darlings through a great gate and see what it does to them. If you're going to do it at all, said Pat, you need to do it before you send any of the family mages through. Once there are other great mages loose in the world. Danny thought of his father, coming home with his power over metal and machinery multiplied by 2. Or 10. And for that matter, what would his mother be able to do? There were gods in the past who really could hurl lightning. No doubt a mage of light and heat like Mama would be able to make lightning after passing through the great gate. Pat was right. The family mages would be godlike, and if they weren't quite scrupulous about keeping their word to Danny, he'd be busy dealing with them. He wouldn't have time to work with his drowther friends to find out just how permanent their drowtherhood might be. Well, he hadn't told the families exactly when he'd make this great gate he was promising. Obviously, he couldn't delay forever. If they became impatient, there was a great gate in existence, one that was not in Danny's control. And that night, as Danny was undressing for bed, he couldn't stop himself from playing through in his mind a not terribly unlikely scenario in which he delayed far too long, angering the families, which then united against him and attacked the Silvermans in order to show their displeasure. Powerful as Marion and Leslie now were, because of their passage through a great gate, they could not stand against the united families, perhaps not even against one family in a concerted assault. Yes, Leslie could detach all the beast mages from their heart beasts. Yes, Marion could break up the earth under them. But there would be threats they couldn't see. There would be winds and water that they couldn't stop. There would be fire. And even if the whole farm in Yellow Springs was burned to the ground, there that public wild gate would be waiting. As the victorious enemies gloated, walking over the burnt-out ruin of the Silverman's farm, their refuge, their lives, someone would accidentally step through the great gate. Wouldn't that be the kind of prank that space-time looked for? No, Danny could not delay forever. But if he took his drowther friends through a new great gate right away, perhaps there would be time enough to train them a little. Maybe they would have latent majories that bloomed into sudden life. Maybe pigs could eat with knives and forks. Even powerful mages born in families took years of training in order to master their abilities. What fantasy was this, that Danny could bestow on his friends what his family had as their inheritance? I am not all-powerful. I may have the most useful magery in the world right now, the one that can change everything. I may have other people at my mercy, but I can't even control a great gate that I made. I didn't know the consequence of weaving into it the lingering outselves of long-dead, rage-filled mages. But the fact that I'm not to blame doesn't mean that I'm not compelled to live with the consequences of my foolishness. How much more foolishness will I have to bring about because of the things that I don't know? It isn't my drowther friends who need training, it's me. But the only person in either world who can possibly help me is my most dangerous enemy, the gate thief. I have most of his gates under my control right now, but who knows what tricks he knows that I am not aware of? Who knows what danger I would be in if I went to him for help? He's a gate father. He can lie to me as easily as he can breathe. So even if he promised to help me, how would I know that he meant to keep his word? And that image of the Silverman's farm as rubble and ash kept coming back to his mind. There was a knock at his door. He felt a thrill of terror, his heart leaping with sudden adrenaline. The families had found him. Then he heard Pat's voice. "It's me," she said. "I need to talk to you." Relieved, his heart still racing, Danny took the 5 steps to the door. The house was so tiny, without remembering that he was in the middle of undressing for bed. When the door opened, Pat looked him up and down. "I see you were expecting someone else," she said. Danny was wearing his tidy-whities and his socks. I was in the middle of undressing for bed, he said, and I wasn't expecting anybody.
I would have waited for you to put on a robe.
She stepped through the door and Danny closed it behind her. I don't own a robe. He walked into the bedroom, picked up his jeans, and came back into the living room.
Don't bother, said Pat. I won't be here long.
Long enough to sit down? Pat looked around. On what? She asked. That wasn't really fair. The house had come with an old tatty sofa, and there was a kitchen table with three wobbly chairs. But Danny always tossed his dirty clothes on the couch, and the chairs were stacked up with books. Danny gathered up the clothes from the couch and dropped them on the floor.
Tidy, said Pat.
Danny put his hand on her back to usher her to the couch. Pat shied away. What are you doing? Danny pulled back his hand.
Offering you a seat? I can find my way to your couch without your hands on my body, she said coldly. I'm not Xena. I don't want your hands all over me. And for what it's worth, she isn't, like, in love with you.
I didn't think she was, said Danny.
Oh, she thinks she is, said Pat. But it's not you she wants. It's to have a god's baby inside her belly.
I'm not a god, said Danny. There are no gods, just people like me. Pat faced him with fire in her eyes.
On the contrary, buddy boy. People like you are proof that there are gods. Dangerous, powerful beings who can do terrible things to people who don't obey them.
What terrible things have I done to you? Pat touched her face.
Oh, isn't it wonderful, my kind master? You have bestowed smooth skin upon your pockmarked servant. Now at last she's worthy to have your hands placed upon her body.
Danny was completely flummoxed. He hadn't meant anything at all by touching her. He didn't know why he had even done it. He didn't go around touching people. There was nothing he could say to change her false impression.
Have a seat while I put my pants on, he said. I told you I'm not staying long.
But she sat down and watched him pull up his jeans.
I don't even know why I came.
Well, we've settled that you aren't here to have sex with me, said Danny. He meant it as a self-mocking joke.
Right. Just because I don't want your hands on me, you think I'm some kind of cold, frigid bitch.
Her words were so out of proportion to anything that had come before that Danny couldn't imagine what was going through her mind. Is that what I think?
For your information, no, I wasn't molested as a child. No, I wasn't abused. No, I don't have any repressed memories of terrible things that now interfere with the natural development of my sexuality. I'm just a private person who doesn't like to be touched.
Danny just stood there for a couple of seconds. It's so good of you to come all the way over here and tell me that, he finally said. Pat sat there, looking at him in surprise. It was as if she was only hearing now what she herself had just finished saying.
That's not what I came here to say, she said.
Her face turned red and she looked away.
I can't believe I went off like that. I don't know what I was...
Danny pulled up one of the kitchen chairs across from her. He didn't even have to take a step to do it, the kitchen being the other end of the living room, and sat on it.
Let's pretend I didn't touch you, and so you didn't react the way you reacted for whatever reason you reacted that way, and let's just say that I asked you to come in and take a seat, and here we are.
He put on an air of jovial welcome.
Pat, my good friend, what brings you here so late at night, considering that you don't want to sleep with me or have my babies?
Pat was not amused at his humor. My parents made me see a shrink because I like to be left alone.
Well, that explains the repressed sexuality thing.
She had an M.D. and a Ph.D., but that just shows they'll give those degrees to any bonehead who puts in the time. She was a fake who wanted to hypnotize me and put false memories into my head. She actually thought she had hypnotized me and started suggesting all kinds of sexual things my father had snuck into my room and done to me when I was 3. She was like a volunteer hypnotic pornographer. Serious child porn.
Ugly!
Pat shuddered. My parents kept making me go back until I finally told my dad what that bitch was trying to get me to remember he had done to me.
But you hung on to the vocabulary. Whenever people go off on how I don't like to be glad-handed or stroked, she comes to mind.
Being an introvert isn't a pathology, you know.
I know, said Danny. I don't like to be touched either.
He thought back to the way Lana had accosted him when he first came to Stone's house, and he realized that he hadn't spoken the actual truth. He hadn't liked Lana touching him at the moment because it was such a surprise and because he didn't like her having control over him. But his body very much liked being touched, and he still remembered that encounter with Lana. He remembered it a lot, and he had imagined several different endings to the event that he much preferred to the way it had actually ended. But he knew that was nothing more than the impulse of his DNA to replicate itself. In fact, like Pat, he didn't like to have people touch him, at least not without an invitation. "I have no idea why I did that," said Danny, "and I'm sorry. I'm also sorry your parents didn't get you, and I'm sorry the shrink was a schmuck. Can we please get on to whatever you actually came for?" Pat turned red again and curled up onto the couch, turning her body partly away from him. He had never seen her look vulnerable before. "What am I doing? Why am I saying these things?"
"Really, please," said Danny. "Tell me what you came for."
"I'm worried about you," she finally said, still not looking at him, still embarrassed. "You're so...
"Stupid?" Danny prompted.
"Yes," she said.
"Not school stupid, not even people stupid. I mean, you're actually very clever and kind of sweet, and I think you don't have a malicious bone in your body, though your sense of humor is sometimes kind of on the mean side."
"Senses of humor usually are," said Danny. "But I see your point. Thanks for the counsel."
"See," she said, "you're joking, but you're also making fun of the fact that I came here at night alone and I've said everything wrong until I feel so stupid I could die. And yet you're also sitting there waiting so patiently for me to finally say what I came to say, because you are sweet, and that's why I'm so afraid, because I don't think you know how evil some people can be."
Pat had no idea what it was like to live inside a family.
"I know a little more about evil than you think."
"I'm not talking about your family," said Pat. "You're the expert on mages or gods or whatever you people are. I'm talking about people in general, regular people, even people who mean well. You're so trusting. You came here to Parry McClure, and you decide you're going to be friends with us, and why? Because the principal assigned Lorette to be your guide on your first day, and you just had to tease her and sit down with us, and how did you choose us?"
Danny had no answer to that. "I was going with the flow. If I hadn't liked you guys, I wouldn't have stayed around."
"But you didn't like us," said Pat.
"I mean, how could you? We're a mess, every one of us, weird on the outside and certifiably insane underneath that repellent exterior."
"But Lorette has nice cleavage, and I am of the heterosexual persuasion," said Danny.
"Maybe that's all it is."
"You're not one of those panting morons," said Pat. "And in fact, we really are pretty decent people, so you could have chosen a lot worse friends. My point is that you didn't know. You had no idea who we were, but you plunged right in as if we were friends, and
then we became friends," said Danny.
"But isn't that how it's done?"
"No," said Pat. "It takes time."
"I didn't have time," said Danny. "I've only got a couple of years of high school, and look, don't you know how I was raised? I've told you. I never met anybody outside the family. When I went to D.C., I only met a handful of people, and one of them became a dear friend. One of them was a user who thought I was his ticket to Easy Street, the perfect burglar. One was a girl who really has the memories that your shrink tried to implant in you, and so she was completely unpredictable and selfish. One was her husband, for reasons I never understood. And then there was the convenience store owner who tried to murder me and my burglarizing partner, and the store owner's assistant who I talked into murdering him, and... Am I boring you?" Pat was covering her face with her hands. She shook her head without uncovering.
"I'm so stupid," she said. "I want to die."
"Please don't," said Danny. "The police would wonder why my fingerprints were all over your back." She laughed in spite of herself.
"I'm coming to warn you, and you know more than I do. You know more about everything."
"No, I don't know anything at all. Really, I just gave you a complete list of all the people I knew in D.C., my complete resume as a friend maker. Unless you count the Silvermans and Vivi, but they kind of had an introduction to me, and believe me, I didn't do all that good a job of making friends with them either. But I had to, don't you see?
I was on the run. My family was after me to kill me. I had no idea how to live outside the family compound. I had to make friends with people and only find out later whether I could trust them. Like Hermia. At first I thought she was out to kill me, but...
That's my point, said Pat, uncovering her face. That girl. She is not your friend.
Danny shook his head. You don't know anything about her.
I know nothing about her, but she is not your friend.
This is about Hermia? You came here to warn me about Hermia?
I came here to beg you to be careful. You trust people that you shouldn't trust.
I trust you, said Danny. I let you into my house late at night. I listened to you because I believe you really are my friend. Why should I trust you and not her?
What could I do to you? Asked Pat. But she can hurt you.
I'm not falling in love with her, if that's what you think, said Danny. She's older than me. But she's like Vivi, a fellow gate mage. She taught me how to lock my own gates. She took terrible risks to follow me, and we teach each other. We help each other.
See, that's it, said Pat. She's using you.
And I'm using her.
No, she's using you. It's all calculation. It's all... And you know this, how? I just do. She needs you right now, but the minute she doesn't, the minute she sees some advantage in betraying you...
But that might be true of anybody, said Danny.
No, said Pat.
Yes, insisted Danny. People are human, even people like me. You can trust people until you can't. They mean what they say until they don't.
That's where you're wrong, said Pat. People aren't all like that. There are people you can count on because they'd die before they'd betray you or even let you down.
Danny thought about that. It was a strange way of looking at the world. I've read a lot of history, said Danny. It filled the time when the other kids were learning magery. And I don't think I remember ever reading about anybody who wasn't human with all the normal failings.
Then you better go back and read again, said Pat. Joan of Arc, for instance.
What about her, said Danny.
She was absolutely true to her voices. She never denied them.
Well, actually she did. She was tricked and trapped, and she recanted and died for it, because in the end she was true. There are people like that.
Lunatics, said Danny. Don't joke, buddy boy, said Pat, because I'm serious. Your cynical attitude about people is mostly right, but there really are good people who can be counted on.
My attitude isn't cynical, it's realistic. Who else is on your list besides the girl who heard voices?
And led armies, and created France as a nation.
I apologize to dead Jeanne d'Arc for speaking of her so lightly.
There was Jesus, said Pat.
That took Danny aback. What about him?
True to his word. A true friend.
To whom?
To everybody, said Pat.
You're a Christian, said Danny.
What about it if I am, said Pat. Even if you don't think he died for your sins, he thought he did. And he went ahead with it. He was true to his word.
He didn't bother explaining to her that the families just thought of Jesus and Muhammad and Moses and Elijah as Semitics. Mages, but not from the families, not from Westall. Jesus and Joan of Arc, he said. Not a very long list.
They're famous, that's all, said Pat. The list is very, very long. There are millions of people who gave their word and then kept it, even at the cost of their own lives, at the cost of terrible agony.
Soldiers who did brave things and died. Businessmen who kept true to bad contracts and lost everything, but they gave their word. There are people like that.
All right, said Danny.
I believe it. And when he thought about it, he wondered.
Am I one of them? He asked. I think you are, said Pat.
I'm a prankster. I lie all the time. I'm good at it. I conned people out of their money all the way to D.C. But I also try to keep my promises. This is so weird. Is it possible that I'm actually an honest man?
I don't know, said Pat.
That's not my point. I know, said Danny. You didn't come to tell me that I'm virtuous. You came here to tell me that you are. Pat sat very still, thinking.
Yes, she said.
That is why I came. To tell me that you're not Xena, who just wants to have a baby with the most powerful man she's ever met, said Danny. And you're not like Hermia, who's just using me and letting me use her because by helping each other we both gain. With you it isn't a bargain or a trade, and it isn't because you want to get something from me. Pat was crying now.
Yes.
Danny got up and sat on the couch beside her, and she nestled against his shoulder, and he put his arm around her, and she cried.
You came here to tell me that you're my true friend, and that I can count on you in a way I can't count on anybody else.
She nodded against his shoulder.
You came to tell me that you love me.
She pulled away, turned, and flopped down against the other arm of the couch and cried even harder.
I'm so stupid, she said. If I'd known that was what I came to say, I wouldn't have come.
Danny put his hand on her back, and she did not recoil. He stroked her gently and said,
You came to tell me that you're the best of my friends, that you're the truest, the most reliable, that you don't think this majory is cool, you think it's dangerous, and I'm in danger, and you don't want anything bad to happen to me, because what you care about isn't power or coolness. It's me. You care about me.
She nodded, and she wasn't crying now. His hand was stroking her back, and when she sat up, his arm stayed around her, and she turned her tear-soaked, red-eyed face to him, and he kissed her. It wasn't like with Lana. Yes, it was, in that his body approved of what was happening. But he wasn't afraid. He took her at her word. He trusted her. And he realized that in all his conversations with his friends at high school, Pat was the only one he actually listened to with any expectation that her words would matter to him at the level of reality rather than entertainment. Which wasn't strictly true, he realized. He respected Hal and liked him, and he thought Hal was also worth listening to. But he wasn't like Pat. He didn't see as clearly and harshly and truthfully as Pat did. He told the truth as far as he knew it, but Pat was far more likely to know true things, so her honesty was more valuable, more reliable. Meaning I can use her. Danny hated the thought as soon as it came to his mind. It was an ugly bit of self-knowledge. He broke off the kiss.
Please, said Pat, and tried to resume it.
No, said Danny. Pat nodded and sat back, facing forward like a scolded schoolgirl.
Oh, I want to kiss you, said Danny.
You're the only woman I've actually felt this way about, though I didn't realize it until just now. I really do trust you and respect you, and you're my true friend, which is what you came to say, and you said it, and you're right, and I believe you. But here's the thing. I'm not as good as you. I use people. I can count on you. But can you count on me? She gave a little shrug.
I can't control that, she said.
I can only control what I do.
Well, I can control what I do, said Danny. My body wants you right now. Tonight. You understand me?
And if I hadn't stopped kissing you just now, you would have let me sleep with you, am I right? She bent forward and hid her face in her hands again.
I'm a terrible Christian, she said.
But I don't want to be that guy, said Danny.
What guy?
The guy who sleeps with a woman because he can. Like most of the guys in our family history. Those gods who got women pregnant all over mythology.
I'm not as good as you are, Pat, but I'm better than they are.
Loving me is going to do nothing but make you miserable.
Pat got up from the couch.
Please, said Danny. I have to get home to bed, said Pat. My folks will worry. They're worriers.
But you would have stayed the night with me.
Because then you would be my family, but you're not.
They are. I have to go.
I didn't lie to you, said Danny.
I could have.
She stood at the partly open door.
I know that, she said. You've been straight with me. You're even better than I thought you were.
I love you more than I thought I did. You love me more than either of us thought you could.
We're never going to sleep together. I'm not going to be the woman in your life, and yet right now I'm as happy as I've ever been in my whole life. Go figure.
Then she went through the door and closed it behind her. I am the stupidest guy in the whole world, thought Danny. I let her go out that door without saying a single word more. But Danny also knew that his decision was the right one. His desire for her was far more than the fleeting interest he had had in Xena, which was based entirely on Xena's eagerness. What he didn't know was whether his desire for Pat was also based on her availability. Maybe Pat was simply more the kind of woman that he was attracted to. Quiet, smart, truthful, a little sharp-tongued, but also kind-hearted. Sort of like Leslie. Sort of like Mama. Maybe that's the kind of woman he would always fall for, and she simply happened to be the first. He was about to do the most dangerous things in his already dangerous life. Whether his attraction to her was just momentary, or he really loved her in a stay-true-your-whole-life kind of way, this was not the time to complicate things. Besides, what if the families had spies watching him? What if she had stayed the night? Then he'd be putting her in danger of being used as a hostage, or of being tortured or killed, because that would be a way to hurt him, the gate father that was always out of their direct reach. He was right to break off that kiss, and she was right to leave, and that was how it had to be. And how did it begin? With him touching her as he ushered her to sit down. Did he unconsciously know even then where her visit to him was going to lead? Did he know deep inside that he felt something stronger for her than for any other woman he knew? No. He touched Pat because that's what Marion did when he was bringing a guest into his house. Always the hand on the back, guiding them in. Marion was something of a toucher. Danny wasn't. But without realizing it, he had picked up the idea that when you have a guest and you want to bring them in, you put your hand on their back to guide and accompany them. Danny had never had an actual guest at his house before, and so when Pat showed up, alone, unexpected, Danny, in his nervousness, unconsciously followed the pattern he had observed with Marion Silverman. That's all it had been. But where it led was to a place much deeper than that. Pat was the smartest of his friends, the most mature. Her caustic nature partly came from the fact that she stood outside everything, observing, the way Danny had always been a permanent outsider. She was the one who was most like Danny, at least in the way she dealt with people. Always detached, always cautious, analyzing. Except I'm not cautious. And where she's silent, I talk, I say things. In fact, Pat is nothing like me, and I'm nothing like her. But I'd be a better person if I were. Then again, she'd be a happier person if she were a little more like me. Wouldn't she? She always seems so sour. Stop thinking about it, he told himself as he took his pants back off and his underwear and socks and slid into bed to try to sleep. Stop thinking about it. But he didn't stop. Pat was all over his thoughts before he slept and while he slept, and he woke up thinking about her in the morning, cursing himself for a fool as he prepared to head over to Coach Leader's house. The last thing he needed was to have a woman on his mind.
Chapter 10 Confession. Wad gated to the farming village in the high country of Iceway. He appeared near the public well, so that there was no chance that his manner of arrival would go unremarked. He came showing his power. A gate mage is in the world. And he came here, and he walked from this well directly to the house where the strange woman and her two damaged, terrified sons were brought only a few days ago. It was the house of Roop and Levitt where Wad walked. Inside, he found, as he expected, that the eldest daughter, Echo, was tending to Anonoe, the one-time concubine of King Priard, and her two sons, 8-year-old Eliuic and 6-year-old Anop. The boys had spent the past 2 years in total isolation, living like tortured animals. For Anop especially, the 2-year imprisonment had been more than half his life, for who remembers anything before the age of 3? Their imprisonment had ended in terror and violence, with soldiers stabbing at them. And then they had been magically gated to this high mountain place, to be cared for by strangers, and their wounds healed, and their mother restored to them, and her children restored to her, and all was not well. Wad did not expect things to be well at all. The boys did not speak, but they saw him come in. They did not fear him, If they thought of him in any way, it would come from the fact that they had seen him magically heal wounds, that he had arranged for them to be fed and kept warm. They would think of him as the great mage who had rescued them from hell, if they were capable of rational thought at all. Wad was looking at the boys, who were looking at him. Anonaway was looking down at the table where she was chopping an onion, chopping it very, very fine. It was Echo, the eldest daughter of the house, who spoke first. "The man in the tree," she said. "Have I done well with them? Do they look strong to you?"
"Yes," said Wad.
"The boys don't speak to me, or anyone but their mother and each other. The younger one doesn't speak even to them. The mother speaks to me now and then. I haven't pressed them. I think something terrible has happened to them."
"It has," said Wad.
"He saved us," murmured Anonaway.
"Yes," said Wad, "I did. But before we can proceed any further, I have to make sure you understand everything that I did, and why I did it. Only then is there a chance that we can work together to try to undo some portion of my crimes."
Anonaway looked up then. "Your crimes?"
"I know you remember me," said Wad. "I know you saw me spying on you from the rafters, back when you were King Priard's mistress and lay with him in the castle where another woman was the queen."
"That was you," she said.
"You winked at me," said Wad.
"You saw us, and you said nothing, though I knew not and know not why. But I winked at you to show you that I knew you were there and that I, too, would say nothing. That's why I recognized you when you snatched us out of our prison cells when the soldiers were trying to kill us. When you brought us to the snow, I thought I knew you, but I couldn't think when or how we met. I thought you were a strange kitchen boy. But you were really a great mage, a gate mage all along."
"I was, though at the time I barely knew it myself," said Wad.
"A gate mage," whispered Echo. "But living in a tree."
"That's one story," said Wad to Echo. "But I'm here to tell another. About how some men came to murder Queen Bexoy, and I, appointing myself as her protector, warned her and saved her life. I showed her then the kind of mage I was, and she showed me the kind of mage she was."
"Bexoy," said Anonaway with contempt. "A sparrow friend."
"That was her disguise. She's a fire master, at least, if not a light rider. And she has the power to make a self-clant so perfect that not only could it speak in her voice, but also when the assassin stabbed it, it bled, and the blood spilled onto the sheets."
Anonoe touched her fingers to her lips.
"No one knew but me. I saw it with my own eyes. I was proud that she trusted me. I became her lover. She bore my son and pretended it was Priard's."
"The baby was yours," said Anonoe. "So Priard didn't lie when he told me that he never put his seed in her." She looked away.
"He was faithful to you," said Wad, "and you joined in plotting against him and against the queen. I know you were guilty of that, and you know what the penalty would have been had you been caught."
"Never against him," she said, "and I was part of no plot. They told me to pack for a journey for myself and my sons."
"You knew what it meant."
She did not disagree.
"Bexoy wanted me to get you out of the way. I loved her, and I did her bidding. But I also distrusted her even then, and so I didn't kill you. What I did was worse. I took you and your two dangerous sons, and I put you in the mouths of old slag tunnels in the face of the cliff, and I made gates that caught you if you fell, and put you back at the top of a cave. So you lived in constant torment, always about to fall, never able to end your captivity by leaping from the cell. That was my idea, my plan. That was how I saved you alive, how I punished you and your innocent sons, because you posed a threat to the woman I loved, and to my son that she was bearing."
"That's a poor excuse," said Echo boldly.
"It's no excuse at all," said Wad, turning to the girl. "It was a monstrous crime against the three of them, and I did it." I thought of it, and I carried it out, and no one knew that they were there except for me. I stole food and gave it to them. As time went on, the food grew better, and I made their imprisonment more bearable. When the queen learned that they were still alive and demanded that I kill them, I disobeyed her. There are a few things in my favor.
Wad turned back to Inonoe.
But nothing makes up for the evil that I did. I tormented you and your sons. Whatever terrors and dark visions inhabit their minds, I caused.
Wad looked at the boys, for his eye caught some motion. It was the younger one, Anop. He had broken his gaze at Wad and was now looking at his brother, and then his mother. His face showed some animation for the first time. But Eliuk remained dead-eyed, his gaze still riveted on Wad.
Whomever you blamed and whomever you hated there in your prison cells and whomever you feared, I was your captor, your jailer, your torturer. What does it matter that I despised myself for what I had done to you? I continued to do it. So let me give you some consolation. Queen Bexoy got the king to sleep with her. You were gone, and so were your sons. He believed that my boy was his own, and now he came to love the queen, and he wanted to give her a baby. So he begot a child upon her. And then she didn't need my little bastard anymore. My son, whom she called Oath, and I called Trick, was now a danger to Priard's true son. He was also the only person that I loved, once I understood that Bexoy had used me, had never loved me. So she murdered my boy, and tried to murder me. On the day I released you from the cells where I had kept you, that was when she killed my son. If she had killed me as she meant to, I couldn't have saved you, and you'd be dead as well. But I escaped from her, and I rescued you. But don't imagine that I had repented of my crimes against you. I meant to let you out someday, and I tried to make your imprisonment more bearable, but I was not about to let you go. It was Bexoy's monstrous murder of her own child, of our child, and her open try at killing me that finally made me let you go. You see that I don't pretty up my actions. Bexoy is a monster, but so am I. If I'm better than her, it's only because I kept you alive and didn't murder you right out. But is that really better? Weren't you just the prey that the spider binds up and hides away to devour another day? I kept you as a tool to use against her when the time came.
Wad fell silent. Echo looked at him in a kind of fascinated horror. He doubted that the boys understood, though the younger one at least seemed interested. Inonoe, though, she understood all. "This is that time," she said. "The time to use us as tools against her."
"No," said Wad. "You're far too weak, and so am I. I was once the greatest gate mage that the worlds had ever known. But now there is a greater one than I. He took all but a few of my gates. I am no match for Bexoy now, and you are most certainly no match for her. I came here to set you free of me, since I'm no use to anyone. I came here to tell you the truth so that you would know your enemies. So you would hate the right people when it was time to hate. Priard had no hand in what happened to you. He searched for you and he grieved for you, but you were beyond his finding. And when he came to love Bexoy, it was only in the firm belief that you were dead."
Inonoe shook her head and laughed bitterly. "Foolish boy. Or are you older than you look? Don't you know that Bexoy was not the only one to hide her magery? Like you, I am a mage, but of a kind forbidden."
Wad had to think for a moment, because if she had been a gate mage, she could have gotten herself and her sons out of prison any time she wanted.
"A man-mage," he said.
"Not a great mage by any means," she said. "But yes, I realized my power when I came of age, when I could flatter people into doing anything I wanted. I began to realize that once I owned them, they were mine. I owned Priard. Do you understand me? He didn't fall in love with me. I decided to own him, and I did." Wad thought for a moment, and then he laughed.
"Well, it doesn't make any of my actions better than they were. but it's nice to know that I'm a monster among monsters. These boys, then. The sons of two mages, and not just one.
I imagine they'll have some talent for this or that when they get older, said Anonoe. Maybe even the much sought-after sea magery. Or maybe one of them will be a gate mage by and by.
It'll be me, said the younger one, Anop. I'll be a gate mage.
Echo clapped her hands together.
He spoke!
Anonoe rushed to her younger son and embraced him. Oh, my baby, no, you can't just decide. The power chooses you. It's already inside you, and someday you'll find out what it is. But Anop kept looking at Wad.
A gate mage, he said. Because you can go wherever you want.
It was in that moment, in those words, that Wad first realized what he had to do. He had come to this place with no plan other than to tell the truth and then take them wherever Anonoe decided they should go. But he heard Anop's innocent words as if they were a recipe for how he might possibly redeem himself. How he might really help Anonoe. How he might get the power to undo Bexoy and destroy her root and branch. Go wherever I want, the boy said, but Wad knew that he could not. He did not have gates enough inside him now to make a great gate, so he could not go to Middlegard. But then he realized that he could. That there was a great gate, a wild one, controlled by no mage now. Danny North could not lock it, and so anyone who knew of its existence could make use of it. Wad could pass through that wild gate and go to Middlegard and back again, restoring what power he had left to its full strength. It would not get him back his gates. Danny North still had those safely locked inside a place where Wad could never go against the young Gatefather's will. But it would sharpen his faculties, bring him back to the state he had once been in, when he saw all the gates in the world, even the gates of the Semitic gods, and he ate them all. Unlike Danny North, he had not been fool enough to try to use the captive gates, but he had found them and held them. He could make himself that strong a mage again. He could restore his own vision, the range of his seeing. And if he could take himself to Middlegard and back again, he could take Anonoe as well. But perhaps not. Wad was a gate mage who knew how to rule over the lost and disobedient outselves that were woven into the wild gate. Anonoe could not resist them. Man-mage that she was, she would know that they were there, but not the form they took. They might entice her out of herself. They might entwine her in the great gate. And because she was a man-mage, they would only be fulfilling the law by taking away her power. No, if Wad were really to strengthen her so she might be a match for Bexoy, he would have to get Danny North to help him hold the great gate open for her. He would have to teach him what to do, to train the man who bested him so that he could never be defeated, and Wad could never get his lost gates back. How could he give even more power and wisdom to the mage who had shattered him? Because I deserved the shattering, thought Wad. He was an instrument in the hands of space-time, and so I got what I deserved. I misused my power, and so I lost all but a tiny shred of it. And I will have to go as supplicant to Danny North, to get him to help me make amends for how I raised the monstrous Bexoy to be mistress of Iceway. All of this came to him between Anop's words and Wad's answer to him. I see that your outself may indeed be divisible, said Wad. It was true enough. The outselves of all children might be divisible, and those that were going to be gate mages would be the most divisible of all. But there was no way to tell at such a young age. But things like that take time. No one knows what you'll become. Anonoe looked at Wad.
For you he speaks, she said. He sees my power, said Wad. He's too young to understand my wickedness.
The wickedness of all the mages, said Anonoe. What did I ever do but seek to advance myself?
And love your children.
Look at the danger I put them in, said Anonoe.
Their very conception was dangerous, said Wad. but all children are born into a world of danger where they're bound to die.
Listen to the two of you, said Echo.
They looked at her, surprised that such a quiet, mousy person would speak to mages of their kind.
Bragging about who is most monstrous, said Echo.
Was I bragging? Wad asked himself.
Monstrous or not, said Enonwe, I want revenge.
I came here so you could have it, said Wad. Against me, if you choose. I will not gate away.
And what then? Asked Enonwe. Without your help, what vengeance can I have on her?
Promise me this, said Wad, that you will not harm her baby.
This from the man who...
I know what I did to your sons, said Wad. I'm telling you now that if you harm her baby, you will not be able to live with it. I know what I'm talking about. No matter how you rage against her, her baby has done nothing. Your children did not deserve to suffer, even though their existence posed a danger to my son. My son did not deserve to die, even though his existence posed a danger to this new child of Priards and Bexoys. And their son does not deserve to die.
So this is the root you found for your morality? Asked Enonwe. Do what you want, just don't hurt the children.
For lack of any deeper root, that will have to do for now, he said. Agree to that, or kill me now, because I'll never help you get revenge against a child. I've gone down that road, and it's too terrible to travel on again.
There's no way that we could hurt her more, said Enonwe.
But what good is it to hurt her if we destroy ourselves in the process? Asked Wad.
Listen to the two of you, Echo said again. All your power and all it is to you is a means to get revenge.
Wad looked at her sadly. I tried to save the world once upon a time, but what I was saving it for, I still don't know. And in the end, I failed.
Then try again, said Echo. The world's as much in need of saving as it ever was, and somebody ought to try.
Enonwe put her arms around her sons.
This is all the world I care about now.
If that were true, said Echo, you wouldn't be plotting vengeance on a queen, a fire mage. You'd be looking for a place to take your sons where they'd be safe.
I thought I had that here, said Enonwe.
We are in Iceway, and your enemy's the queen, said Echo.
And by the way, man in the tree, thanks for bringing the king's missing mistress to our house. That will help us prosper, you can be sure.
I didn't know anywhere else to take them, said Wad.
Well, I've done what you wanted, and I'm not turning them away even now, though if it's discovered who they are, her enemies will happily kill me and my whole family, don't you think?
Wad slumped down to sit on the floor of the tiny house. I think that I'm the puppeteer pulling strings, but then I trip on them and find that someone else has hold of my strings.
Who?
Asked Anop.
Fate, said Wad. Unintended consequence. That's the only god that's real.
Do you have an actual plan? Echo asked Wad.
Yes, said Wad. As of this moment, yes, I do.
Chapter 11. Reunions. Danny hadn't had enough sleep, but his inner clock woke him at exactly the time required for him to make it to Coach Leader's house for a special practice. Now that Danny had capitulated and ran his fastest for a leader's stopwatch, he found that he enjoyed it. Showing off, not competing. Danny was human enough to like being admired. And one thing about Leader, when he was working with an athlete who was really trying, he knew how to show respect and give encouragement. It was a side of Leader Danny had never seen, and never would have seen as long as he was with the Slackers and Geeks. He was still with the Slackers and Geeks, but he was also running for the Parry McClure track team. And even though it was a while before any of the meets would begin, and for all he knew he wouldn't live long enough to compete in any of them, it was fun to get to Leader's house before sunrise, running the whole way in the dark,
and then see how Leader had laid out fixed courses for him on the streets of Buena Vista, so that he would know just how far Danny was running in a given amount of time. Now that his friends were all enlisted in the Great Gate Project, the only way that Danny still connected with high school life was his running. He had come here to get away from Majory and live a normal life. He had brought the Majory with him, and running was the only normal thing left for him to do. This morning, though, Coach Leader wasn't alone. Nikki, his daughter, was with him, and though she seemed a little sleepy, she didn't have that wan look, that dying nymph appearance. Her passage through a gate had healed her of whatever she was dying of. Leader may not know it, but Danny had prepaid him for all the private track coaching. And yet it had cost Danny nothing, the effortless gift of a god. Need healing? Well, here it is, because why not? But just because it cost Danny so little didn't change the fact that she was dying, and now she would live. Maybe that had something to do with why Leader was more encouraging than Danny had expected. After all, he had so much less to feel angry and bitter about. "Do you mind if Nikki watches?" asked Leader. "She was up anyway, so..." Did he think he was good at lying? Danny knew that Nikki must have asked him to waken her especially for this. And maybe Leader was simply indulging his little girl. Or maybe he thought Danny would perform better with a girl watching. Or maybe he hoped something might happen between Danny and his daughter. Though why Leader should wish for such a thing, Danny didn't know. It had to be the first one. Nikki liked Danny, and what's not to like, and when a daughter who had been this close to death now had a crush on a boy, what father wouldn't indulge her, especially when he was right there to supervise any interaction between them? Danny felt her eyes on him the whole time. He ran short sprints today. Leader was keeping him close to the front porch, so he was never out of Nikki's sight. And if the idea was that Danny would work harder to impress a girl, it wasn't exactly wrong. He certainly made his best times in the various dashes, and this despite having run the whole way here and not having had enough sleep the night before. "Last night I was this close to pledging my undying love to Pat, and this morning I'm showing off for Nikki. I'm such a teenage boy," which is to say I'm such a fickle jerk. Well, running in front of a girl wasn't kissing her. There was a difference, and he'd keep it well in mind. Even in the cool of an autumn morning, Danny was dripping with sweat. He had really given it his all, and he knew that sweat wasn't unattractive to girls, not when it had been earned by real exertion, not when the guy doing the sweating had an athletic build. It was only sweaty fat kids and geeks that turned high school girls off. Danny had learned this from his reading of young adult novels during the years he was studying to prepare to be a normal high school student. "Hi," he said to Nikki when Leader beckoned him to the porch. She gave him a little wave and a shy smile. Leader ignored the exchange between them and began reading off the times. "And you ran here, right?"
"Yes, sir," said Danny.
"So the idea is to have these sprints in here at the end of a long race, to pace yourself so that you stay in contention, but you don't have to lead."
"You know that I don't care about leading," said Danny.
"But the team needs you to win, to rack up points. So not for yourself, but for the team. You stay close enough to be in contention, but sprints like these are still inside you."
"Why not just have me run the sprints?" asked Danny.
"I've got guys who can do the sprints. They're not as fast as you, but they win enough. I need you in long distance. You're a coin I can only spend once or twice in a meet. I'm not going to use you up on the short stuff."
"You want me to be a quarter, not five pennies, is that it?"
"Yeah, smart guy," said Leader. "I want you to be a damn Susan B. Anthony dollar."
"But 50 cents will do," said Nikki. "He wants you to try for the dollar so you might make the 50 cents.
Leader reddened. If any other kid had said such a thing, he would have been angry. But it was his daughter, so the redness went away quickly. "She thinks she sees through her, old man," he said with a smile. "But I want the buck. I want a buck 50. "Well, I better get home and shower," said Danny.
"Oh," said Nikki. She looked disappointed. Then, realizing that Danny was looking at her curiously, she stepped back and turned away embarrassed.
"Nikki's going back to school today. She was kind of hoping you might ride with us."
Danny indicated his dripping shorts and T-shirt. I can't go like this.
You could shower here, said Nikki.
Then she covered her mouth as if to keep more words from coming out.
And put these back on, said Danny, laughing.
Look, said Leader, Nikki's right. I've worn you out with sprints. Now, if you run all the way home and shower and change, you'll be late to school.
It was true. They had gone long.
You shower and throw on something of mine. It'll be baggy on you, considering that you're made of toothpicks. But we'll swing by your house and you run in to change. We'll wait.
Danny considered for a moment. It was a very generous thing. But could he afford to arrive at high school in Leader's car?
How about if you drive me home and drop me off? Then I can walk to school on time.
Well, I'm not letting you get in my car as sweaty as you are right now, said Leader.
He laughed, but was it really so important that he shower at their house?
Danny shrugged and stepped up on the porch.
Whatever I do, I gotta do it now.
Nikki rushed ahead of him and showed him to the house's one bathroom. It really was an old place, but the tub was modern enough. It wasn't sitting on claw feet, it was molded to the floor, and instead of a shower curtain, there was a glass door. He turned on the water and heard Nikki close the door behind him. He got his shoes and clothes off as soon as the door was closed, and by then the shower was steaming a little. He got in and was washing his hair with regular soap when he heard the door open.
Not looking, not looking, said Nikki.
He couldn't look because he'd get soap in his eyes, so he'd have to take her word for it. When he got out, there was a towel laid out for him, and a pair of pants and a shirt in a style no self-respecting kid would wear. No underwear. His own clothes were nowhere to be seen. She must have taken them. She was going to wash them for him. She was showing him how domestic she was. No, she was trying to do something nice. Give her credit for being kind. Don't assume that girls want your body just because Xena does. Xena knows you're like a Norse god. The only way the pants would stay up is if he held them with one hand while he held his shoes with the other. He went barefoot out of the bathroom.
Somebody stole my clothes, he said. But we'll have to search for the thief later when I'm wearing pants I can run in.
Leader laughed. I didn't think anybody could look worse in those clothes than me.
He doesn't, said Nikki.
Then blushed. Then laughed.
Can I make it to your car barefoot? There's not any, like, gravel or hot coals or anything?
Their driveway was gravel, but it ran around the back of the house.
It's all paved, said Leader.
Back door.
Danny followed Nikki out the door, catching the screen with his shoulder because both hands were occupied. Only after he was through the door did she remember and turn back to hold it open for him, and so her reaching hand smacked him in the chest.
Ow, she said. Your chest is hard.
Sorry it got in your way, said Danny. Like your dad said, all toothpicks.
Then she led the way to the car, which stood on a paved carport pad. There was loose gravel all over, though, so Danny had to pick his way carefully to the back door.
Nikki ran around and got in the front passenger side, and Leader backed them down the driveway and out into the street. Only now did Danny realize that they didn't know where he lived. Nobody knew that except his friends, unless they had looked up his school records, which they must have done because Leader drove right there without any directions. Of course, in the days when Leader was spying on him to try to catch him running and time him, he might have seen where Danny ran to after school. Surely he hadn't planned this out far enough in advance to consult the school records.
Thanks, said Danny, as he got out of the car. I'll bring these clothes back to you at school.
But they didn't drive off. They followed him up the short walk into his house. That bothered him. He hadn't invited them in. In fact, he had made it clear he wasn't inviting them in. So he had to gather up his clothes that were scattered in the living room and retreat into the bedroom to change. When he came out, there was Nikki washing the dishes that had stacked up by the sink.
You know, if you rinse them right after you use them, they're easier to wash.
But I don't mind scrubbing, said Danny.
Now you won't have to, she said, drying her hands. At least not the ones I washed.
Danny looked around for the coach.
Daddy went back to the car. He said this place was too messy for him to find a place he trusted enough to sit there.
Yeah, well, I wasn't expecting company. Though, in fact, it had looked just like this when Pat came over last night. Hadn't expected her, either.
We'd better get back to the car, he said.
But she didn't get to the car. She walked up to him and put her hands on his waist, shyly. How does a girl shyly do something as bold as that? But she radiated shyness even as her hands rested on his waist just above his jeans, so that her hands were